It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, I don't want to tussle with experts about the healthy Mediterranean diet, but there's a clinker in the theory. Supposedly, for centuries, people ate more plants than meat, and even poor folks used healthy olive oil. Well, the clinker is the pig. Most people had one. And if the poor had olive oil, they sold it to survive. And they sold off parts of the pig, too. The sausage, the salami, the ham. But the one thing they kept was the fat, the lard, because it made anything taste better. Which is why, by the way, lard is trending right now. So stay with us for pork goodness and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Chefs become famous for a lot of reasons. Some you might question, but with others, you always want to see what they're doing next. Well, right now, the food world tracks Sean Brock's every move. He's the chef of two restaurants in Charleston, Husk and McCrady's. Now, the reason for the tracking, Sean is bringing back old, forgotten Southern plants, ingredients, and dishes, and he's doing it brilliantly. He works with historians and scientists and farmers, and this man is deep into transcendental pork. Well, Sean joins us from Charleston. Sean, good to talk to you. Good to have you with us.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you so much.
So, Sean, I know you are part of the lard core movement in the South, right? This is a group of you chefs down South who are really digging into Southern traditions. But what is the most important thing about lard for you?
Well, you know, for us, we don't use it because it's trendy. We don't use it because of any other reason than the fact that we use whole animals and we have lots of lard. And so if you think about it, that's the way it used to be. That's the old-fashioned way. You slaughtered a pig and used every single part, and you used lard until you ran out of it, and then you slaughtered another pig. And so for us, we're very focused on using the entire animal. So we have lots of lard, and it just works its way into our cuisine, and it doesn't hurt that it's absolutely delicious.
And this is very much a part of Southern history, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was the primary fat source pretty much throughout the 18th century and certainly the 19th century until really Crisco was invented, which was the very early part of the 20th century, around 1910 or 1911, I believe. People grew up eating it, and you know, people are scared of it these days because they think it's so unhealthy, but it actually has less saturated fat than butter.
Huh.
It's all in moderation.
Yeah. Yeah. So for you, when you work with lard, what kinds of things are you doing with it?
Well, for us, it's really our primary cooking source. You know, at Husk, we have a wood-burning oven, and pretty much everything goes in there. And we just have a huge container of rendered lard, and instead of, you know, canola oil or anything like that. So if we're cooking a piece of catfish, if we're roasting a chicken, we're using lard. It goes so well with that wood-burning oven. Just makes things so delicious.
I've heard tell of lard caramel sauce, which sounds pretty interesting.
Well, you know, it's so much fun to work with if you just think of it as a fat. So one thing that we do that I think is really wonderful is we put it into the smoker and we smoke it and we render it in the smoker. And then we have this smoked lard that we then turn into a caramel and we'll sometimes add some whiskey to it. And you can serve that with just about anything. It's unbelievable. We pretty much can take any recipe, a pound cake even, and just any of the fat that's in any recipes and use the lard. We've even been known to take it and spin it into cotton candy.
You're singing my song. So can I make lard at home?
Well, you know, here's the thing. There are several kinds of lard, and it all comes from different parts of the animal. You have the leaf lard, and then you have the fat back. I think the most prized is really the leaf lard, and that's what people want to use for, those wonderful, flaky, delicious, tender pie crust. But there's not a whole lot of it. That's the lard that's right around the kidneys. And it's really, really sweet and really delicious and really allows you to have that flaky pie crust. But the fatback is certainly wonderful, and there's tons of that. And there's a million different ways to do it. You know, if you want to render lard for your home, there are two ways. There's the dry method and the wet method. The wet method, you actually add water to it and boil it, and that helps retain the smoke point.
Uh-huh.
So if you're going to be using it to really cook with at high temperatures, like to roast and sear,
right?
Then you want to use the wet method, because the dry, you literally just put it in the pot, and so that's reducing your smoke point. So for us, we always do the wet.
So the wet would be, I would take whatever fat I have that would be attached to meat, perhaps, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it could be any from any part of the animal.
From any part of the animal. So I could be trimming it off a pork chop or any of that. Mm-hmm. And I could even store it in the freezer maybe and then do it all at once, right?
Right. And so the fat won't emulsify into the water. So, you know, you render it down, Basically, you're melting it. And
then into the water.
Melted,
yeah.
Mm-hmm, and then you can remove the fat from the water by refrigerating it.
And then the fat just floats on the top. I take it all out and I've got lard.
Yeah, and one thing that's a lot of fun to do is to flavor that lard during that process with maybe some hard herbs like rosemary or marjoram or thyme and some garlic and some chili flake and some lemon. And then we'll mix it with butter or at the restaurant. That's our table service. That's our bread service. So we take butter and lard, flavored lard, and we whip it, and then that's what you put on your rolls.
Small quantities but really delicious. Now, what about the commercial lard sold in the stores?
Well, here's the thing about that. There's actually two things to remember. One, it's not coming from a heritage breed pig, so the flavor is really not going to be there. And two, in order to allow it to be shelf-stable, you notice they don't refrigerate it.
Right.
It's hydrogenated, just like Crisco, which I think affects the flavor a little bit and the texture. My suggestion is to get to know a butcher that is proud to carry heritage breeds, and I can promise you that they have lots and lots of lard lying around.
And if they don't make the lard themselves, they can give you the fat and you can make it yourself.
Yeah, and it's so inexpensive and it's so delicious. It just gives your food so much character. Use it like butter. You know, people use tons of butter and everything. So I think that as long as you use it in moderation, there's nothing wrong with it, and it can really add a lot of character to your food.
Sean Brock, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Sean Brock is chef at McCrady's and Husk in Charleston, South Carolina. Now, for more information on his work with Heritage Foods, go to the website splendidtable.org. If you read Eric Asimov's wine columns in the New York Times, it becomes quite apparent that Eric drinks for pleasure, plain and simple. But it also becomes apparent that he does not think wine should be completely demystified. Eric writes about this duality in his new book, How to Love Wine, a Memoir and Manifesto. Eric, good to have you with us. Welcome.
It's my pleasure, Lynn.
So, Eric, am I right in saying that I think you want us to stop worrying about what's in the glass and just enjoy it, but also leave a little of the mystery intact?
That's exactly my point in this book. There's so much pleasure in wine, and we create so many obstacles to feeling that pleasure. We feel that we have to know so much about it. We have to be able to describe what we taste. We have to know what sort of barrels those wines were aged in, what sort of dirt the grapes were grown in. And that's all fine if you're that curious about it. But that's not a prerequisite for enjoying wine. And I think we've let the wine obsessives in our society define how to appreciate wine. And I'm going to make a point here that there's a big difference between the great mass of wine that's available out there and the small amount of wine that is made with care, with intent, that is somehow an expression of culture. It's a little bit like mass-produced food and good restaurant food. There's a real difference in it, and we shouldn't lump it all together. Most wine critics don't separate the two kinds of wine, and I think that's a major problem. The wine with the funny picture on the label, 15 million bottles a year, is very different from the wine that's produced in a small vineyard by a family that's been doing it for centuries.
Okay, then. Can you give me an example of something that you love?
Yeah. There's so many great stories in California. And, you know, we've had a tendency to focus on the wines that get the highest scores and so on. I'm looking for wines that have a connection to the land, that have a history of expressing the qualities of that particular place where the grapes are grown. You know, I look at a place like Napa Valley, and one of my favorite Cabernet Sauvignons there is Mayacamas Vineyards, and this is a historic place that's been making great wine for decades, but it's been kind of disregarded lately because it stylistically doesn't fit into the popular notion of big, powerful, fruity Napa wines. Mm-hmm. And yet they've been making such wonderful wine in a consistent way that really expresses the philosophy of the Travers family that's been making the wine, the dirt in the west side of Napa Valley where the grapes are grown. And I feel it's a shame that it's been kind of disparaged because it doesn't fit stylistically in with what's popular today.
So which Cabernet is it and what does it taste like?
Well, it's a Cabernet Sauvignon, and to me, it's a wine that needs time to develop. And it used to be that we expected most great wines to require aging. And in recent years, this has changed. We've made wines that are more accessible immediately, maybe at the cost of the ability to keep for a long time. And you know, when you ask what it tastes like, it's a hard question to answer because I resist the use of the sort of listing of fruits and flavors and flowers to describe wine. But I would say that this wine has a texture that captivates. It feels so good and it's fresh and refreshing that you want to keep drinking it. And it does connote flowers and fruits, yes, but it doesn't really matter which ones. It's just delicious. And Lynn, when you talk about demystifying wine, do we really want to break that wine down into a dozen flavor components? You know, in a way, that's saying that the human has control over the wine, where the great thing about wine is its unpredictability and its changeability from year to year, from hour to hour in a glass, as it ages. That's the mystery of wine that I think needs to be preserved.
How about another example?
Well, I think a little family operation, Mathiasen Family Vineyards. This is also in Napa Valley. It's a fascinating experience to visit the Mathiasens, and it harkens back to the days when wine was really just a subsistence crop like anything else, a farm raised. They raised their grain, their vegetables, their animals, and their grapes. And I feel as if that's the connection that we're missing today. The bottle of wine that belongs on the table with the bread and the meat and the vegetables represents wine's true place as a staple. And it can be so much more than that. But if you approach it from that direction, I think that you will develop much more of a sense of ease with it.
Mm-hmm. Eric, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Eric Asimov is wine critic for the New York Times, and his latest book is How to Love Wine. Now, for information on the wines Eric talked about and a recipe to go with a big red, it's called My Favorite Beef Daube, and it's from Dory Greenspan. Well, all of that is up on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, we're going to be back with the women chefs who can stand the heat and stay in the kitchen. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Charlotte Druckman is a journalist who writes about food from a lot of different angles. She writes for outfits like The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Bon Appetit. But it was a piece that she did for the journal Gastronomica that set off her book. Now, the article was Why There Are No Great Women Chefs. The book now is Skirt Steak, Women Chefs on Standing the Heat and Staying in the Kitchen. Charlotte joins us from Portland. Charlotte, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
So we've heard an awful lot about, you know, women in the kitchen, but how did you approach this book?
Well, I wanted to write, I say jokingly, but it's not that much of a joke, the anti-woman chef book. Because I do think that we tend to have the same conversation every few years, and it doesn't seem to be helping. And that conversation is usually coming from a defensive or negative point of view, which is to complain about how difficult it is for women or how there aren't any women out there or why they all leave. And if you look around, you find so many women in professional kitchens. Not obviously as many as men, but still more than I think people realize. And so I wanted to look at it as a norm and look at this group of women who have made great strides and have them talk about how they've done that.
Right. So how do you define this word chef? Because boy, is it tossed around a lot.
It is so hard. And that became, I think, the biggest question of the book. You know, originally chef was it was a trade. It was a craft or an art that you honed. And now it can be as micro as, you know, learning how to chop perfectly and how to work a grill station perfectly and working your way up through that. But it can also mean not just running a galley. It can mean running a whole restaurant, owning multiple restaurants, creating a line of products, being on television, writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did for the book was I used a very specific definition, which was to say anyone who had been in the position of an executive chef or had been in charge of a galley.
So going back to this idea that you didn't want this to be, you know, again, a repetition of this conversation that's gone on for a long time about how hard it is. But how hard was it really for these women? You talked to, what, 73 chefs,
yeah,
right?
73. You had, you know, you run the gamut. You will have some women, and some of it's chronological. I think a lot of the women who were rising in the ranks in the 80s and early 90s will tend to have stories about really being treated not kindly at all in the kitchen. Someone like Beth Oretzky, who is best known for having been the character called the grill bitch in Anthony Bourdain's book, Kitchen Confidential. I mean, she'll talk about how that's what she was really exposed to often. But then you'll talk to chefs who are working now who just either it's not happening as much or they literally tune it out, which I think is also interesting. It's almost like they put blinders on and they just look straight ahead and get their job done and they don't have time for it. And then, you know, you'll have some chefs who – I think Nancy Silverton was a great example. She kind of avoided all of those typically French male-dominated kitchens being on the West Coast. And she just had these really lovely – I know this is an annoying word when you're talking about any kind of women's related topic, but nurturing experiences and from a lot of male chefs.
See, I think that's – yeah, that's an interesting take because the boys' club concept, right –
Oh yeah.
Is it still alive and well?
I think I call it now the New Boys Club because it's a different set of boys and it's a different club. I mean, I think they think of themselves much more as kind of rebellious and envelope pushing, but they mostly tend to be boys. And I don't think that they're thinking about it that way. I don't think that anyone's walking around actively discriminating against women. Mm-hmm. I just think they've all found each other. They like to hang out. And once you have that kind of circle that has a certain amount of clout, you know, that they can throw around, it just all tends to kind of spiral from there, right? I mean, they just keep picking up more traction.
What were you hearing from the women? I want to say, I hate the word generation, but what were you hearing from the younger women who are now, you know, established in food? I'm thinking about people like Amanda Freitag or Alex Guarnaschelli, who you see on Chopped, for instance.
Well, it's funny because I almost think of it as there being three generations in the book. And they represent to me the middle generation, which in a way it's like your adolescent phase. It's the most awkward. They grew up while the term chef was going through the most flux. So when they started, there wasn't much of the celebrity thing or television. But as it developed, their careers were developing. So they kind of had to adapt with it. And I think it makes them really great commenters on how that works. Alex, who is so smart, notes in the book that to be on television as a woman who cooks usually means that you are put in a framework where you are considered an expert in the home, whereas the male chefs are given the credit for being experts in the professional kitchen. And, you know, she's someone who is such an accomplished professional chef, and she even knows that that's what's happening, and she's, you know, she's part of it.
Wouldn't that make you crazy?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, but I think on the other hand, you have to think of in any profession, if you want to succeed, you're going to do whatever it is you need to do to get the kind of agency you need to be able to express yourself. So if it's going to help you get more money or more attention, and then you can somehow use that to get whatever your personal message across is, I think that's how you have to do it. You know, I mean, you can say I'm going to stand above it, but then that also means that you might never get heard. And so you have to decide at what point you're willing to bend, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Charlotte, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Charlotte Druckman is author of Skirt Steak, Women Chefs on Standing the Heat and Staying in the Kitchen. Now, you can check out Judy Rogers' infamous bread salad recipe on the website, splendidtable.org.
Okay, let's see what we have in here. Got some fish sauce with some ballpark mustard, mango chutney, ketchup, soy sauce, green curry, red curry. That is old. That needs to go. We've got dill pickles, of course. Two little sweet pickles.
Have you ever had one of those moments, faced with a refrigerator filled with half-empty bottles and jars of the world's condiments? The Chinese black vinegar that you needed for the noodle recipe back in 1997? Or the tamarind for the homemade chutney, vintage 2005? Well, what do you do with these leftovers? According to chef Susan Feniger, you need to organize them into tastes. She's the author of Susan Feniger's Street Food. Managing producer Sally Swift got the details.
Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me on the show.
This book is very much a hands-on cookbook, but it's also a book about travel. How integrated is food with travel for you?
Completely. I took my first trip to India 30 years ago, and honestly, I think it changed my whole perception about food, about the direction that I was most passionate about. And I don't think I realized it at the time, but it's influenced everything in terms of colors I love, my palate, the flavor profile that I am drawn to. And it really set the tone for the next 30 years for me.
It's interesting. The book certainly represents that. And you have somehow managed in this book to organize the world's kitchens by its ingredients and their flavors, which I think is just brilliant. Can we walk through the way you've broken down things for us? Let's start with the salts, for instance.
Okay. Well, so, you know, what's interesting is One of the common threads that I think I see in every cuisine is this use of different ingredients and their flavor profile. So, for example, the salt. So, you know, even if you say, okay, in the French kitchen, there's capers and anchovies. That's the salty element. I mean, there's many elements, but those are the salty elements I can just sort of pull out right now. Then you go into, you know, Southeast Asia, and you've got dried shrimp and miso and fish sauce or tamari or soy sauce, those kinds of things. Then you go, you know, where there's brines, or you go like into Mexico, for example, and achiote has a bit of that sort of salty, from the annatto seeds, has a little bit of that saltiness. It makes the other part of the dish come up. It's almost like it forces it to step up.
And those are all cultural variations.
Yes. It's like the checkmark of an ingredient list that I really think brings everything in line.
Now, the second thing on your list is interesting because I think of it as a checkpoint, too. It's the sours.
No question.
And so give me a list of what you consider the sours.
So in the sours, then we sort of lay out the categories of like pickles and vinegars. And so, for example, umeboshi plums or rose hips or tamarind, hibiscus, yuzu, fermented grains, wines. Adding sour to a rich dish makes that dish come about. So for me, for example, the Malaysian black pepper clams, well, that's very, we put in oyster sauce and soy sauce. That's extremely rich and salty. Add into that tons of fresh lime juice. All of a sudden, it totally changes the whole dish.
It's all about the balance.
You know, it is. You know, on a Cubano sandwich, that's a great sandwich loaded with, you know, all this roast pork and ham and really delicious flavors and mayonnaise and mustard. But what makes that dish are the pickles that you put in there. That's what, I mean, that sandwich without the pickles is not a great sandwich.
Right.
And it can't be a little. It's got to be that every bite that you get. So even on like the pizza or the flatbread, we might make an Italian parsley salad just tossed with a little bit of lemon and olive oil. That then gets sort of laid over the whole pizza when it comes out so that every bite's got just a little bit of lemon into it.
Sounds delicious. Okay, now at the other end of things, you have a list of your sweets, which has an interesting list. Palm sugar, maple syrup, sorghum, molasses, dates, blossom waters, honey, dried fruits. Onion you consider sweet. I assume it's because you caramelize it. It becomes sweet when
cook
an onion.
Yeah. Now, I mean, onions, for an example, I mean, the onion's got almost more sugar than any other vegetable. So when you caramelize an onion, I mean, in the Thai kitchen, shallots are cooked so they are crispy. And the reason for that is because they're adding sweetness to a dish, natural sweetness to a dish. So, yeah, for sure. You know, in India, you'll see all over chutneys that have tamarind, which is the sour, but then it's sweetened with either dates or raisins to make a chutney that is sweet, but it's also sour and it might have heat. I mean, we as Americans are so sweet. Our palate is so used to sweetness, but I think we're limited in terms of that we haven't explored as much as many other countries where you start to use the sweetness from, you know, other ingredients, like, you know, where it becomes a really big part, like date syrup is used. We do a date and carob syrup over our lamb meatballs in the new book. We do these lamb meatballs. Now, they're great. They taste great. But boy, you add that date carob syrup with the feta cheese sprinkled around that. So now you've got
totally irresistible, right?
Yeah. I mean, sweet syrup and salty cheese. I mean, it's the sweet, salty, acid thing. I just love.
It's true.
Totally love.
To finish out, to round out this pantry, you divide the last two categories into the hot and spicy, which I think everyone can wrap their heads around, including mustards and cinnamon you include in there, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Why is cinnamon there?
Well, I think that, you know, it's interesting because I think that cinnamon, even though it's sweet, there is something about it that actually has a little bit of a kick, like ginger. Same thing, I think, is like black cardamom. It's not hot, but it definitely is spicy.
It's interesting. So, and finish up with this mellowers and coolers, which I guess every cuisine needs, right?
Well, yeah. No, I mean, no question. I mean, for sure, for me, you know, boy, the thing that we're most familiar with is the yogurt, you know, this very wonderful cooler, which is a yogurt sauce known as Raita, made in all these different ways. You know, in the Latin kitchen, you've got the same thing. You know, you might have a spicy salsa, but oftentimes it's finished with, you know, crema, which can be also a cooler mm-hmm. on there. Mm-hmm. Or it's, you know, those combinations like avocados, I think, add that same thing. Avocado adds richness, but it also adds this sort of cooling element because of its mellowness. It mellows out a dish. Mm-hmm. It totally does. I mean, and certainly, you know, in the French kitchen, you know how it is. You have a sort of typical red wine reduction, like, you know, in a Beurre Rouge. The butter mellows that out. Or right. you have, you know, a Madeira sauce. You whip butter into the sauce. That mellows it out. I mean, you fold in a little bit of cold butter. Wow. It changes the whole, mm-hmm. you know, texture, flavor, mellowness of the sauce. Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting and very organized of you to group all these things, I must say.
Okay.
Susan, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Chef Susan Feniger is author of Susan Feniger's Street Food. Now, find Susan's recipe for lamb meatballs with date and carob molasses on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at our podcasts. Dig into the recipe box. Everything's there, and it's waiting, splendidtable.org. Hey, stay with us. We're going to be back with your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Yeah. Look like it needs some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I see it look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, call us, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Paul's on the line from Sweden. Paul, what's going on? What do you want to talk about?
Well, my wife and I, we decided to kind of stop what we were doing, and we bought a house, opened up a little bar and cafe, and we're serving some food. Probably
where,
the best cheeseburger in Europe.
Oh, my God. Where are you in Sweden?
Smaland.
Where is it? Where is it in relationship to Stockholm, for instance?
We're about 3 hours by car south of Stockholm.
Okay.
It's the area where Orrefors and Costa Boda, the famous glass,
oh, yes.
comes from. And IKEA was started here.
Oh, my goodness.
This area.
Well,
so it's a little small village in that part of Sweden on the east coast.
But it sounds like it has the entrepreneur gene, which is ideal for someone who's going to do the best cheeseburgers in Europe.
Well, we lucked out. Right down the street is a guy who gets local beef. He breaks it down himself. It's dried and aged and hung like all the good stuff. And all the fancy restaurants buy all the good bits. And then here I come walking down the street going, hey, this is what I'd like. And he says, oh, I got a whole bunch of that. You can have that. So we cut a good deal on this really excellent beef. So all of a sudden, we didn't start out to make cheeseburgers, but now all of a sudden, geez, it's a pretty good one.
So what's your place like? Is it a cafe? Is it a restaurant?
Well, it's a very small village, so we tried to create a place that is accessible to everybody. It's a bar, but uh-huh. it's kind of in an Art Deco style. The house was built in 1921, so we wanted to kind of keep the karma of the house going and keep that theme. So we picked up some of the features from that part of time. Like all of Sweden, it's got a wood floor and no rugs, white walls and old furniture and things like that, and we spiced it up with some modern stuff and, of course, some IKEA stuff, and here we are.
Well, congratulations. By the way, I realize I could talk to you for a very long time, but I think you called with a question.
Yeah. Oh, here we are. We decided to open this place. We're only doing fresh food. We're making what we think we'd like to eat that day, what we see in the market or what we can get. and we're in the heart of potato country. All the best potatoes. Matter of fact, probably the best potato farm in Sweden is right up the road from us.
Wow.
We've got 20 different kinds all year round. I can't do frozen French fries now, so
no,
I have to come up with something that I can make fast, that's safe to hold, that I can put together quick when an order comes in,
right,
and is delicious. And I'm just stumped. I've tried different things, and, well, I've heard people call in with all these questions over the years, and I said, I'm going to try it. She's a genius.
Don't get your hopes up.
Okay, Paul, here's the thing. Now, you want to serve this with a burger?
Yeah, we're doing burgers. I'm going to get into some probably braised meat sandwiches this winter, long-cooked stuff. And
Is one of the requirements that it has to be something that's eaten with your fingers?
No.
Okay, because you know
knife
what I was
saying?
Knife
and fork is fine. Matter of fact, Europeans only eat cheeseburgers with a knife and fork, so.
Right, right. But this is, okay. You know what I'm thinking? How about a gratin? Everybody loves them. They're utterly delicious. They reheat, you know, forever.
Absolutely.
And they keep. And you can do little squares of it, you know, and you can take those little squares. You're going to have to work the recipe a bit, okay? And I can't give you one that's absolutely foolproof off the top of my head.
Yeah, don't worry. I'll find
one. But I would say, you know, one of the great places to go for a great gratin recipe would be Julia Child.
Okay.
But there's other, I mean, there are other really good sources. But the idea is it's thin slices of potato, okay, layered with a little grated nutmeg, salt, pepper. You could put some garlic in there, very thin, you know, slices of garlic. And you overlap those slices. You kind of fan them and keep overlapping them. And what some people like to put cheese in between. But what happens is the cheese really starts to get yucky if you're doing a lot of reheat. But what you do is you pour in cream. Or broth and cream, okay, good broth.
Right.
And you can add whatever flavoring you like in terms of herbs or spices. And then you take that little baby and you put it in an oven and you slow bake it until you can run a knife through it easily. And then if you want to, you can top it with cheese. But I think the great idea would be when you serve little squares of it,
okay,
that's when you put the cheese on and let it sort of melt and use one of the local fresh cheeses that has a lot of tang. So look up, try out, do some test runs on a couple of recipes for gratin. You might find one on our website, certainly, splendidtable.org. But it would show off those potatoes because essentially it's some...
That's the star. That's what we want.
Yeah, and you've got 20 different kinds of potatoes?
At least. Would you suggest like some kind of waxy potato?
Yeah, you want a waxy potato for this. You don't want something that easily mashes. Okay.
Now, the perfect one.
Right. That's one way to go. And then, and I say you want to make it so it holds together so you can cut those little squares and then pan brown them. Or you can just heat it up. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking little squares that you pan brown in a skillet.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Or you stick in the oven and you get it crusty. And then you can pull it out and put a little cheese, some shredded cheese on top, let it kind of turn creamy. But that's what goes on the plate next to the burger. And I think it could really be dynamite. The other thing that you could do, and you could do this ahead and then is make mashed potatoes.
Okay.
This is borrowing an idea from India. Make mashed potatoes, flavor them with herbs and a bit of chopped onion. Okay. This is where you might use a combination of the waxy and the floury. I still love the flavor of waxy potatoes. And then what you do is you make patties and you stuff the inside of the patty with some sort of sauté or vegetable mixture or maybe some good local cured meats. And then you've just got that lined up in the fridge, and then you cook them right next to the burger.
Right down in the meat juice and the cheese and all
Well,
that
not
stuff.
Not all the meat juice and the cheese, but the idea is you put them on a griddle or you can put them browning them, and then you season them any way you want, but right there you've got this little stuffed potato patty, and it could be fabulous. And again, that can wait. You know, once you've got it all together, it can wait and you can have different flavors.
You can keep them in the refrigerator for a couple of days.
Yeah, yeah. And again, you're going to want to test run this with what you've got locally, how your equipment works and all of that. But those are two ideas that should lend themselves, and they're not expensive.
How good is this?
I think it's pretty good.
Wow.
Hey, you know what? Check in with us periodically and let us know how the business is going.
Really?
Yeah.
I'd be happy to.
Okay. Hey, and thank you, and great success.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. This has been fun.
Yeah, it has been. Take care,
cool.
Paul.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Stephanie's on the line from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Stephanie, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hey, Lynn. It's a pleasure to talk to you today. I have a very pleasant problem. I have a copious amount of figs that my trees produced this year. And then my local grocery sold a bunch of pork tenderloin tip roast for a very special price. And so I've got a lot of pork and a lot of figs.
Oh, oh.
And they should go together, but I don't know how to make it happen exactly.
Well,
I'm hoping you can help.
Well, I can definitely help, and this is a marriage made in heaven. Okay, first thing that comes to mind is butterfly those tips, a couple of pieces of those tips. You know, just take a chunk of meat and cut it down the center and open it like a book. Don't separate mm-hmm. two pieces. We could separate it into two pieces. The idea is you want to have that meat set up in a way that you could slow pan grill it. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah. And then is it very lean or does it tend to have good marbling?
There's a little bit of both. There's some silver skin, but of course I can trim that off.
Yeah, you want to trim off that. So that's that sheer grayish silvery, literally silvery skin that gets very chewy. So you trim that off. But the idea is this. If you wanted to brine that pork to make it very juicy, you could. And that would be for every quart of water, you'd have about a quarter of a cup of salt. Don't use table salt. Use something like kosher salt. Okay. And then you might have the same amount of brown sugar. And if you wanted to, a little chili powder, not because you want heat, but it just adds nice flavor. You're not going to get heat that way. Or whatever seasoning you like. But this is what I would love to have you do, is to slowly pan brown and slowly cook, the way you would cook a good pork chop, pieces of that. And then when you take it out of the pan, what you're going to do is take halved figs that you've just dusted with black pepper and some brown sugar. Okay, and a little salt. Ooh. And you're going to put them dusted side down first in the pan to caramelize that, and then flip them over. It's going to take moments to do this. And then flip them over, just cook them a few minutes, and put them on the plate next to the pork. And then what the next thing you do is you're going to make a pan sauce. And the pan sauce is going to be some white wine and some chopped up garlic. And you're going to just scrape up every bit of the fig and the brown bits. With that, boil it down until it's a syrup and just streak a little bit over the pork and the figs. Yeah, not bad.
Sounds very good. So I wouldn't want to try something like balsamic vinegar?
Yeah, you could. And by the way, you could take some inexpensive balsamic and stuff those figs in it. And let them sit in a cool, dark place for about a week and a half. Then you can pull out those figs and you'll have figgy balsamic. Or better yet, you can do the Italian number where you take raisins and dried apricots and fresh figs and balsamic vinegar and red wine and brown sugar and cloves and cinnamon sticks and a lot of black pepper. And you cook that all together and you make sort of a chutney. And you stick that in your fridge, and you can use that on anything from something with cream cheese or ice cream right on down the line to something like your roast turkey.
Oh, that sounds divine.
It is not a bad thing. And then the last thing you can do is figs and brandy, which never hurt anybody.
No.
Hey, I think you're going to have a good time with all of that.
I do, too. Thank you so much, Lynn.
You are welcome.
I appreciate your time.
Well, I appreciate your calling. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
You too.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Tweet us, find us on Facebook, send us an email, splendidtable.org. Professor Patrick McGovern is into beer and wine. What's curious here are the vintages that he's into. You see, McGovern is scientific director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Laboratory for Cuisine, Fermented Beverages, and Health at the University of Pennsylvania Museum in Philadelphia. And all that is to say that this man likes to turn up old beverages. His idea of a great beer is usually something that comes from an ancient tomb. He's written Uncorking the Past. Patrick, it's good to have you with us.
Well, I'm very glad to be with you, Lynn.
Well, I understand that you found a connection between beer and King Midas, he of the golden touch. So what's the story here?
Well, the basic story is that the University of Pennsylvania Museum excavated a tomb in central Turkey back in 1957. It was at the site of Gordian. You've heard of the Gordian Knot.
Yeah.
Which, you know, was cut by Alexander the Great, and he became ruler of all of Asia. Well, this is the capital city of the Phrygians, and the most visible feature at the site is a large mound that covers a tomb that is very wonderfully appointed with the largest Iron Age drinking set that's ever been found, for example.
Huh.
And it is of a period in which Midas, there was a real King Midas, might have lived and been buried in, or his father, Gordias. And so there was a funerary feast that was held at the burial of the king, and then the leftovers in the drinking set, for example, were deposited with the king in the tomb. And they were sitting in the Pennsylvania University of Pennsylvania Museum for the last 40 years or whatever, until somebody suggested I, you know, get involved in doing an analysis of those residues. And it was one of the easiest excavations I was ever on. I just had to walk up two flights of stairs, and there were the original residues sitting in the bags that the American excavators had used to collect them back in 1957.
So what did you discover?
Well, then we went to work and were able to focus in on fingerprint or biomarker compounds that tell us what the original natural products were that went into the beverage. And in this case, we could discern compounds that pointed to beeswax that was present there. And where you have beeswax, that is a good sign that you originally had honey, because you never can totally filter out all the beeswax. And then there was a compound called tartaric acid, which is found in large amounts in the Middle East only in grape. And then there were compounds that pointed to barley. So we had a combination of barley beer, honey mead, and grape wine.
Wow.
So this is like mixing together everything, you know, the kitchen sink sort of.
Right.
And so we were very interested in, you know, whether this was even palatable. And what we planned to do, and which we did do ultimately in the year 2000, was to have a whole recreation of the ancient funerary feast for Midas or his father. And the tomb itself is dated about 750 to 700 BC, in that range.
Uh-huh.
So 2,700 years ago, they had this, you know, fantastic funerary feast, and we wanted to recreate that. So each year, we had a tasting with Michael Jackson. Now, this is not the entertainer, but the...
No, the famous beer authority.
The famous beer, Scotch authority. He would come here for a tasting at the Penn Museum, and a lot of microbrewers would come along as well to show off their wares, and I explained that we'd come up with this very strange beverage, and if any microbrewers wanted to get more details, they could come to my laboratory the next morning at 9 o'clock, which, you know, for a bunch of microbrewers who've been up all night, that might be expecting a little too much, but the next morning there were like 25 microbrewers on the doorstep to my laboratory. And they all went back to their breweries, started churning out all these strange concoctions.
So which one won?
Well, ultimately, Sam Calagione of Dogfish Head Brewery, which I was already somewhat predisposed to because I just by chance had his Shelter Pale Ale, and I was really amazed at how aromatic and, you know, almost like a wine some of his beers were. And so I suggested to him that for the bittering agent, maybe try saffron, because hops were not something that were available until much later in Northern Europe. And, you know, he was willing to try that. And it turned out to be, you know, fantastically aromatic beverage. The only problem is that saffron happens to be the most expensive spice in the world. So this turned out to be the most expensive beer that he'd ever made.
Yeah, and this is the King Midas beer, right?
Yeah, and this then ultimately became the Midas Touch, which appropriately enough went on to win many gold medals. It was a golden touch.
I love it. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, I'm very happy to have done that. Enjoy your next beverage, whatever it might be.
Thank you.
Patrick McGovern is author of Uncorking the Past. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Steve Mirsky, writing in Scientific American, on why beer is better than wine. Human feet are conspicuously absent from beer.
The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Now head to splendidtable.org to find information on anything you heard here this week. Get registered for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, browse our recipe box, and get registered for our monthly giveaways. It's all there at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Alexandra Baumhart. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.